From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. American workers, and by extension their families and communities, have always been affected by where the jobs are and what the jobs are. Today we'll look at two examples of the changing face of American business. In the book, In the Rings of Saturn, Joe Sherman explained how General Motors came to build its Saturn automobile factory in tiny Spring Hill, Tennessee, and how 7,500 American auto workers came to work there. We'll discuss what happened in this peaceful southern town. I'll also talk with Rebecca Morgan. She's president and CEO of joint venture Silicon Valley Network. We'll look at how this group, representing business, government, and education, has mobilized forces to retain Silicon Valley businesses, replace the many jobs which have left the Valley, and to prepare its citizens for the jobs of the future. In The Rings of Saturn, Joe Sherman writes about the departure which General Motors took in building its new factory for the Saturn automobile in the rural South. I began by asking Joe why Americans should be interested in this story.
Primarily because it's a story that's kind of full of elements that are important to the culture right now. The whole question of whether we can compete on a global scale, whether we can make quality goods with technological input that are also heavily rely on labor. Thirdly, can we expand our technology, improve the way we do things, and also not ruin the place that we do them in? In other words, that the core of my book is the conflict between growth and place. And Saturn, being the size it was and going in this rural backwater, really has become a model for this ongoing growth scenario. I think that's going to be repeated endlessly in the next century. You see it now with Mercedes in Alabama, BMW in South Carolina. Those are just the biggies. But very few companies are located in urban centers, but they love to locate in that suburban fringe, you know, where farmland gives way to the growth pattern. And can we relocate there, revitalize the economy, and not create the same kind of suburban havoc, traffic patterns, declining quality of life that we have this whole post-World War II period.
Let's start with what they were trying to do with the car. The company was to put engineering before accounting and people before machines. Was that so hard in the automobile business?
It was not hard 50 years ago, but in the 60s and 70s when management and labor came to such loggerheads, the idea of putting people before machinery was radical by the mid-80s in the American automobile industry. The automotive industry was going to eliminate labor, was not going to have to deal with the union. So there's this ongoing battle to try to replace people with machinery, which ultimately came to this big impasse where no matter how developed the technology was, how many robots you had, you still came back to the same equation. People make cars, not machines. Machines make parts. Machines do certain operations, but ultimately the people are the glue of the operation. And without a labor force that recognizes that and has some sense of self-esteem, some sense of participation, you get lousy cars. This is basically why the Japanese make good automobiles. And it was discovered by the American manufacturers, once they got desperate in the early 80s, they started actually going into some of these Japanese plants. The Japanese didn't have better technology than us. They didn't have more robots. They had fewer machines. A lot of their plants, ironically, reminded these executives of American automobile plants from 20 years ago. But the people had some sense of involvement in the making of the car. They worked in, it's become a cliche almost now, this whole idea of working in teams in America, but they worked in teams. They relied on each other. Somebody had to go to the bathroom, somebody covered for them. Somebody was sick, they came in late. The other eight people took over for this ninth. The ninth one came in. It was a human system. whereas the American system had tried to isolate people, not make them cooperate. So Saturn really was a giant step backwards in the human relations field.
It was clear that General Motors, one of the big three, was committed to making this a separate entity. I mean, they created a wholly owned subsidiary, which is a large corporate word, means a separate company. Did they really feel they had to create this separateness from the rest of GM to do this?
Saturn as a concept was set up by 99 people, about half union, half management people, who they let travel around the world visiting different factories, GM factories, foreign factories, Japanese factories. They've set up something called the Saturn Study Center, and they, one of the mainstays of that was this plant had to be not only mentally, managerially removed from General Motors, but had to be physically removed. Because GM is so powerful, it's kind of like a black hole. And if you didn't get far enough physically away, you could have all the greatest planning in the world, and it would be very hard to implement. That's what's going on now, is GM has been kind of reeling in Saturn, even though it's 600 miles away.
Well, they put the plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee. How did they come to build it there?
That actually still remains somewhat of a mystery. In my research, I was able to find out exactly when they did it and who did it, but why is still a question. There were 1,000 towns competing for Saturn in 1985, 36, 38 states. It was one of the largest industrial sweepstakes that America had known. And when the numbers had been reduced to 3 or 4 states, one of which was Tennessee, Spring Hill, the town that finally was chosen, was not even one of the communities considered. It hadn't applied for Saturn, hadn't tried to make itself one of these communities with the infrastructure. And then once it was announced, Spring Hill lacked the water, didn't have the interstate connection, didn't have many of the things that General Motors said were absolutely crucial if this plant was going to be located in your community. It's a wonderful example for economic development officials about going to the wall to try to make your communities competitive, and then having some community out here that had none of this stuff gets the job.
It was so small. Where did all the workers come from?
They all are UAW workers that have moved from other General Motors plants.
So they were offered a package, I guess, to move to Spring Hill, or did they just voluntarily pick up and go?
A combination of two. They had to voluntarily apply for Saturn. When Saturn first became a reality and they were building the plant, they hired people in shifts. The initial people went through a training center and became the nucleus of Saturn that helped train some of the other people. But it was initially it was a hard decision for people to make, because Saturn was radically different. You're going to take a pay cut. Initially, production was supposed to be keyed into your wages, which was very unique for the automotive industry. But it seemed to draw younger people, because anyone that was working for GM in 85, 86, 87, the plants were closing, sales were down, the median age was getting up in the early 40s, often in most plants. And so the people that did apply for Saturn, then you had to go through a series of tests, go down and be interviewed. Your team, once you had the nucleus of a team, they hired their own teammates. And so the plant the workforce kind of grew out of its own momentum. And that was, again, one of the very unique parts about Saturn's conception.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Joe Sherman. He's the author of the book, In the Rings of Saturn, about the risk General Motors took to manufacture the Saturn automobile. You talk about Saturn lingo. Give us some Saturn lingo.
Oh, the people that you would call a foreman in the other world are called WUMAs.
Called
work
what?
Unit module advisors, WUMAs. And then there are CPMs that were people who were the heads of teams. There are business unit advisors, BUAs. They have a lot of acronyms to identify. There was SAC. There was this Saturn Action Council. They talk about ramping up, launching, all these different terms, some of which actually come from other aspects of the automotive industry. But one of the comments one of the VPs made to me one day is, if you want to start a new company or do things differently, you have to have a new language. And in some ways he was right, I guess. They redefined old jobs and gave them a new twist, often with a new name.
I noticed there were a lot of systems, like the assembly line became vehicle system.
Exactly.
My personal favorite was the vice president for people systems.
Yes.
Is that personnel?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Everything
hiring
had to be renamed.
Hiring and firing.
Yeah. Now, the key word throughout all of Saturn was quality. What quality were they talking about?
They were talking about quality initially, the way that it was defined in a book that I mentioned, The Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Quality is a sense of constantly improving, not a goal that you actually reach, but some idea that you would continue to improve what you did as a process, always trying to make it better. And that contrasts vividly to quality that deals with just statistically making, let's say, 95 out of 100 parts have to be within the statistical range, and they all pass, and that means you're doing quality work. Saturn idea was you tried to get 99 parts out of 100, and then you refine the tolerance of your inspection mechanisms or your inspection system. So then you started to get 99.5 parts out of 100. You were always trying to make things better. This is really copied. This whole idea of continuous improvement is an aspect that was copied from the Japanese system. But that also was originated in the Japanese system from this American who went over there, Dr. Deming, who's become very famous as this guru for quality, who made the quest for quality the core of any kind of business. It's the same thing, personal improvement, individual improvement. And Saturn really was concerned about that. How do you make each person on the team better, more consistently concerned about quality? And a lot of it's a headset. You know, the idea that quality is something you always pursue. You never get there. I think I make comparison, it's like enlightenment, the New Age movement. You know? You're always trying to get there, but very few people ever get enlightened. Same thing with quality. To really make quality whatever you do, and often I think you can associate this with art and crafts, you know, you're always trying to improve.
Now, there were some new manufacturing techniques and/or technologies, such as the skillet that came out of the Saturn experience. Tell us what you can about that.
The skillet is an interesting device. It's basically an escalator that goes horizontal. And instead of people, and it's used in the assembly line aspect of manufacturing,
the vehicle systems,
exactly. Okay. You have basically four parts of a plant. One part makes the motors, one part makes the bodies, one part makes the air conditioning, all the other stuff, and the fourth part puts it all together. The skillet's in the fourth part. And as these parts come in from various directions, the skillet allowed people that were putting them together to stand beside the car, and as the whole car moves along on the skillet, as opposed to having just the car be on a track where you were always walking along, putting your door hinges on, and then walking back and putting your door hinges on again. You kind of move along on the skillet, doing your job, and the skillet either goes right around in a circle or it kind of stops, and then you go back and you do the same process again on the skillet. The carrier systems, the conveyor systems, are quite fascinating too, because they go all over the plant and they kind of bring, I always love the painted body panels, because they look like a carapace on a lobster. You know, some painted black, some painted green, some lavender. And they kind of float by overhead. You see these things floating around. And they come down often on a diagonal The part that I loved was the marriage, pre-marriage unit, where you actually have the assembled body comes down almost like a shell right over the top of the drivetrain. And then there are these six or eight people bolting everything together, you know, and trying to put fluids in and stuff like this. But that's actually called the marriage unit. It's where the body gets married to the drivetrain. The whole paint system, this waterborne paint that more manufacturers are using now, I don't understand the chemistry of it, but it's much easier to deal with in a waste context what you have to throw away from painting, because painting traditionally has been one of those aspects of manufacturing, particularly cars, where you had a lot of waste and they didn't know what to do with it. Waterborne paints have a wonderful texture to them. One of the strong selling points of Saturn initially was they kind of had this watery, fluid look to them. And this waterborne paint does that, but it's also very hard to apply. They had a heck of a time initially working out the kinks in that system without getting drips and runs and all that stuff that obviously don't turn people on in the showroom.
After a few early presidents, the president since 1986 has been Skip LaFave. How is his style different from the stereotypical auto chief executive?
Number one, he doesn't wear a tie. Number two, he's very sincere guy who, in some ways, wears his heart on his sleeve. It's gotten him in trouble sometimes with Saturn. But he doesn't spend as much time in the plant as he would like. I talked to Skip LaFave numerous times, and one of the things that stuck in my mind was he said I asked him if he worked for a Japanese company, which one would he want to work for, and he said Honda. And this seems to be kind of reflected throughout Saturn, the engineers. I asked a lot of people this question. They almost all said Honda. And LaFave said that Honda's president had an office right in the middle of the factory. And a lot of the engineers and VPs had desks right out on the floor. They weren't in a separate building. And even at Saturn, his office is in a separate building. And he said, I don't spend enough time in the plant. If I could do anything, I'd knock down the walls of this place and move it right into the factory. And that is a big change, although he hasn't been able to pull it off. He's still separate from the working environment. He also was more accessible. General Motors is notorious for being hard to get to, and believe me, that's true. As an investigative journalist myself, I would never have started this book if I knew how hard GM was to deal with. Naivete kind of kept me going for the first few years, and perseverance the last few, because they are very hard. I think I'm the only reporter that's been allowed in the plant for a length of time. I spent a week on the crankshaft line in late 91. And they're really into information control. You know, you go in, people are with you all the time. And they let me in, ironically, because I introduced myself to then chairman of the board, Bob Stemple, at a media function that I just kind of like slipped into the side anyway. I went to Detroit and interviewed Stemple. And after that, doors kind of blew open, at least temporarily, till he got canned and the new guy is in for GM. And now they're right back to not answering your phone calls kind of thing. But anyway, LaFave, again, was accessible, that a lot of GM people are not accessible at all.
My guest today is Joe Sherman. He's a regular contributor to Smithsonian Magazine. And in his latest book, he examines the effect of something which many of us thought we had seen the last of in the United States, bringing a modern automobile plant to a rural area. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. With the new Saturn plant, 100 acres under one roof, and was it 7,500 employees, how has life changed in Spring Hill?
Like a slow detonating bomb that had psychological, economic, and physical consequences that have been spreading out ever since the plant was announced in late July of 1985, with no end in sight. It's one aspect of development that is usually not given much attention, and I think it needs to be given more attention all the time, because we are on one hand, extremely concerned about economics, about growth, about competition, or on the other hand, are very much concerned about the environment, what we've done to the countryside, how we're going to live in the future in an environment that's attractive and that people like and that isn't totally dominated by the car culture and suburban aspects of that. And Maury County was a rural backwater that needed an industrial hit, no doubt about it. Saturn promised a lot of opportunities for that area. And the plant itself has been very inconspicuous out behind these bunkers they built and very hard to see. It's not any kind of visual blight on the environment at all. But the numbers of people and the impact on schools and then the tax break that Saturn negotiated so that the tax burden is being picked up by the locals who've been there for a long time, and then they didn't get any of the jobs. They thought that initially, oh boy, you know, anybody that can add two and two together is going to end up working on this automobile plant or working at one of the suppliers. Number one, the UAW got all the jobs in the plant. Number two, the suppliers didn't locate because speculators came in like locusts the day after the announcement of the plant, bought everything in sight. Land prices went up 12, 15, sometimes 25 times what they had been 2 days before. And have stayed, if not that high, very close to that high. So Maury County almost eliminated itself as a place where suppliers could locate. They didn't get the jobs. There's a tremendous amount of resentment towards the Saturn employees by locals who anticipated jobs, which is really too bad because they're really of the same ilk. You've got working people in the area who needed jobs. You had UAW people who needed jobs, wanted to move someplace and do a good job, have come down there. They should see eye to eye, but there's been a lot of animosity. And this kind of ongoing change, now they're talking about building another plant down there. And if they do, you just have this kind of continual ripple effect, you know, where the people who are working in the local businesses, they may make $6, $8, $9 an hour. And if you work at Saturn, there's two pay scales. One is about $24 an hour and the other is $28 an hour. So you're in different economic worlds. And that gap really needs to be addressed. Saturn has always been in a state of denial about it, that we don't need to give people jobs, that the ripple effects handle everything and they don't handle everything. And the state really, I think, abdicated its responsibilities on insisting that all the help they gave General Motors building this 6-mile interstate connector, providing extensive job training, pretty much ushering them into this area, had an obligation to the rural area and did not fall through on it. There's a 3-way partnership here. You have big business, the state, and a rural community. And they had the two biggies, the state and GM, plopping this plant in a place, great expectations unrealized, and still saying, well, you're glad we're here, aren't you?
As far as the jobs go, you're saying that the responsibility basically rested with Saturn/GM and perhaps the state. What about the UAW? Did they have a part in this?
They had a crucial part. When I talk about Saturn, one of the early questions, Saturn is a partnership between labor and management. So the decisions made at Saturn are not those of management primarily. They're a partnership deal between labor and management. And the UAW has been a partnership to all the decisions all the way along the line. And the UAW recently has been real adamant about not allowing any jobs. I think management, it's interesting, all the time I've spent down there, top management and people that work on the floor all say that these people should be given some jobs. The UAW International in Chicago, middle management in the plant, and other people in General Motors know we have a responsibility to our people first. We're laying off people around the world first. They have to be given these job opportunities, which in a way, it just should have been a percentage. They might have given 10% of the jobs, even 5%, but they gave none. And that's what really hurt and made people. So there's a lot of anger down there.
Well, we've all seen Roger and Me about what happens when you pull out. I didn't really think about it when you pulled in.
Well, one of the things I point out in my book is that it's hard to drive down there and imagine 40 years hence, maybe weeds growing up through the cement, windows broken in this vast 100 acres under roof, everybody gone. Okay, you think back of Detroit post-World War II, 40 years ago, plants going up over the place, rehabbed, everybody moving up there. With the changes in technology, the rapid global shifts of power. Right now, I mean, the Japanese, 5-6 years ago, they were top of the world with car manufacturing. Now they're struggling, laying off people, can't compete because of a super strong yen. They are in where we were 10 years ago. So will you see a place like Spring Hill all of a sudden deserted because the plant, it's cheaper to build someplace new, or we're going to build cars in China, or we're not going to build cars at all, we're going back to Detroit? You don't really know, but you do know, if you extrapolate from the past, that that plant will be abandoned. You go to Detroit, great ruins. Ecorse, if you like ruins, Detroit's a place to go. I personally like Detroit a lot. But it's a wonderful example of what happens when an industry uses a place up and then just takes off. And when it's so concentrated, you don't have anything there to keep people going. And the automotive industry has had a history of kind of using places up.
That is interesting when you think about the environmental issues, about developing products and saying, okay, what happens to the products later on after people are done with them. That design of places, of factories and any of the things attendant to the factories so that downstream they can be used further.
I think it is a parallel to what we're looking at with cars now. I mentioned to you earlier, I just came back from the Tokyo Motor Show. One of the companies most involved with interesting concepts of the future is Volvo. Volvo's now been united with Renault, the French company. They look at their automobiles now in a three-part phase: production of the car, operation of the car, and recycling, dismantling of the car. And they have something called energy environment unit to something, and they apply them all along the life of an automobile to determine really how much energy does a car take. And it's not only its manufacturing process, but its operation. How, even with an electric car, is it going to be fueled by batteries that are charged from a fossil fuel plant, from a dam? It's a different impact, environmental impact. Is that car made so it's going to be able to be dismantled and the fenders remelted, the block melted down, or is a lot of going to have to be thrown away and put in a landfill? An automobile plant, to extrapolate on a large scale, really needs to be looked at the same way. When you place an automobile plant in a southern rural area, why isn't the economy and the people that live there, that have spent their whole life there, that have a sense of quality of life, why should that be totally impacted without sharing in the positiveness of the plant? I'm a rural person myself. I initially went to this story intrigued by the impact of this huge entity on a rural area. And an automobile plant, not only automobiles, but any large industry really needs to have the same thing. You're going in. What's the impact when it initially goes in? What is the operational scenario? Some people are going to get local jobs. You're bringing other people in. And what's going to happen at the end? Is this plant going to be reused? Is it going to be able to be turned into another kind of industry? Is it going to be able to dismantled? Or is it just going to be a blight on the landscape? And so I think that's what 21st century industry needs to look at. You can't keep locating every place else. We run out of places to relocate. Well, we haven't run out of them totally, but we're going to. This environmental green age and business more and more have to waltz to the same tune. And they realize that, but it's a big shift in thinking and a big shift in how you do things.
Now, we've dealt sort of sociologically with the impact on the people in Green Hill and the impact on the workers, just from a different orientation, sort of the work environment. When you went in and you spent this time with the workers on the Saturn plant, were their attitudes different than you would expect?
No, they were like working people are around the world, forthright, honest, speak in a language you can understand, hospitable, and tell you the real story. They were great, and I was really impressed. I'd met a number of people before who were worked for Saturn, but actually being with one of the teams, they were great. They told you about the warts on the frog, that all this teamwork stuff, some of it works great. One of the things they were very big on is, a team, we have not gotten to the point where we're really able to discipline our own members, and that's a big key to a successful team. If you can only do the nice things, then finally, if somebody is really getting way out of hand, they're coming to work late all the time. No time clocks at Saturn, by the way. No job descriptions, okay? People share a team. A team has a job to do. People do different things on that team, but they can switch off at different work if they have to. They have a system down there, a red, amber, green system about putting people in different areas of being in trouble, being warned. But actually implementing it has been very difficult for these teams because it's not something they had done traditionally. It's always the boss will do it, okay? This guy's screwing up all the time, but the boss will take care of him. Now the team actually has to talk to him. You have these team meetings all the time, conflict resolution, decision making. But actually doing that on the team, it was very hard. And this is what the members made very clear. It's very hard for them to actually become the teams that Saturn envisioned. And I think that, again, goes back to the union. The union has insisted that even at Saturn, wages still not connected with productivity as much as initially anticipated, a lot of protectionist measures to really make the teams not have to be as independent as they wanted to be and probably really need to be if you're going to have a real lean production situation. Because ultimately, if Saturn's going to survive and become a real strong independent division, it has to be a profitable piece of General Motors.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest today has been Joe Sherman. He's author of the book, In the Rings of Saturn, published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Rebecca Morgan is president and CEO of Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network, an organization which joins representatives of business, government, and education. I asked Rebecca to tell us about the organization.
Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network is a collaborative effort between business sector people, public sector people, educators, members of our community, whose mission it is to retain jobs, create jobs, and prepare the workforce for those jobs in Silicon Valley.
Who belongs to the network?
The network doesn't really have a membership. The network is myself and six employees, three on the payroll and four on contract. A board made up of 26 people, and that I think is what represents who's involved in Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network. They are executives from companies in the Valley. They are elected officials from the Valley. They are leaders, mostly executive directors of associations like the American Electronics Manufacturing Group, school administrators. They are the champions, as we call them, of our initiatives. So there are really four sectors that contribute members to our board.
How did this all start?
Joint Venture really started as a need to have a luncheon speaker at the San Jose Chamber of Commerce. And Joint Venture Silicon Valley was a term that someone had heard or conjured up. And from this luncheon came such energy and enthusiasm for the need to look at the Valley, do a six-month study that came up with a report called An Economy at Risk. That report really showed who was leaving the Valley and where the hope for the Valley rested. for instance, there's still great growth in environmental technology. We could really be the hub of environmental technology in California, which is badly needed as we clean up military bases or Superfund sites and all, or prevent pollution in the future. We're really still growing in software. We're still growing in business services and a lot of the biotechnology companies. What's leaving are the manufacturing jobs and the semiconductor jobs for the most part. This report generated people with a desire to say, okay, we know the problem, let's go solve it, and let's rejuvenate the valley. And from that 12-month effort came a report called the 21st Century Community. And that's really what we're all about, rebuilding community in collaboration with corporations.
You know, when I think of Silicon Valley, and I think most people do, we think of it as an international landmark. It typifies what can happen when suddenly there's a spur of technology achievement. But it's really made up of, as you're saying, there's government, there's community, there are businesses, people live there. And there's no city in the United States and no set of communities in the United States that doesn't have this problem of balancing the jobs with the people, with the needs, so that it's almost as if finally Silicon Valley came of age and started, instead of just being in a boom period, started to mature into a standard.
Well, it's maturing. It's also suffering from the recession in California, not as badly as Southern California, but still suffering from that, suffering from the fact that throughout California, government and its legislators and administrators really didn't look too favorably on business. They liked the tax dollars that came from business, but they weren't quite sure business was good. And I think we have seen the results of that negative attitude. Businesses go where they're wanted and stay where they're appreciated. And they weren't very businesses have not been appreciated in California over the last decade. And we're suffering because of that.
The network's report, Blueprint for a 21st Century Community, describes clusters. What are clusters?
Clusters are those groupings of companies that are sort of a vertical, you know, structure. Mm-hmm. For instance, as we develop the ability to help people start a company, you could consider it a cluster in one way, where someone can go to our enterprise network and get help on developing a business plan, the legal and financial help that they are seeking. The enterprise network doesn't provide that help. They have a library of resources for the person wanting to start a company. Then you could go on to an incubator, where free space or reduced price space and support services, secretarial, fax machines, and so on would be provided for, say, up to 10 companies, startup companies within this incubator. And then if a company became successful and had a product to export, we refer them over to our global trading center. And that center would put together the package, the financing package, the freight movers, contracts, and so on, to help them export more easily than they would if they had to put together all of this marketing packages by themselves.
So what is the cluster?
It's job creation. And then we would have break down into different groupings. For instance, one of our objectives is to improve the infrastructure through Smart Valley, which is our networking, electronic networking and communications endeavor, the technology center, work on creating jobs, the defense base conversion, looking at job training so that we have a better prepared workforce.
Why is it that the government can't do such a thing, or why is it that private industry can't do it on its own?
I believe that government has a purpose, and that is to provide those things that individuals and companies can't do for themselves, like an education system, like a transportation system, like a justice system. But it's not government's job to create jobs. That is the private sector, in my view. And business is there to create jobs, not to worry about the sewer system and the transportation system, but they can work together collaboratively rather than as enemies, as we've often seen government people or business people see each other in the past, can understand the collaborative advantage of streamlining the permitting process, for instance, in a city, so that a business doesn't take as long to build a new building to develop a new product. I mean, it doesn't do much good to have a business have to go through 3 years of permitting when their product can only last 18 months, like much of our software and computer technology today. So cities have had to come to understand that they're not there to be a self-perpetuating, you know, bureaucracy, but they should be there to help business succeed. On the other hand, business shouldn't necessarily look on government as the enemy. They should work with them in developing tax policy that is good for business, but also provides a stable base of funding for our cities. And I think it's that dialogue. For instance, we have a tax and fiscal policy council within the joint venture network. And these are people that have never talked with each other before, CPAs, business executives with governmental officials, to say there's mutual gain here if we work together.
Now, where does the funding come from for Silicon Valley Venture?
All of the funding to date, beginning in early 92 to the present, has come from companies in the Valley, two or three companies in San Francisco, the remainder of it from Valley companies. Since I came on board on September 1st with Phase 3, the implementation part of Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network's efforts, our largest contribution has been the $250,000 that Bank of America has provided, because they truly believe it's only when we rejuvenate the Valley, create new jobs, employ more people, that they have a banking opportunity. Another major contributor is PG&E, who are always looking for utility customers. And I don't think you convince people to give large sums of money unless they see some self-interest. And I don't think that's unhealthy.
A little fact of life.
Even KQED may find that necessary.
Well, I'm afraid we bow sometimes to that, that fact of life. You touched a little on this earlier, but with all the success of Silicon Valley, what's there really to be worried about? How bad could it get?
In the late 80s, early 90s, our defense spending, you know, the federal dollars coming into the Valley, dropped 17% in about 5 years, and it's continued to drop. We don't have the latest count, but well over 25,000 jobs have been lost in the defense and space industry in the Valley in total. We've seen new startups drop by 50%. We've seen business failures double from about 82 to 92 when our study, The Economy at Risk, was completed. There is worry. There was a trade show in San Jose recently in which 40 states were exhibiting and were trying to attract companies from the Valley to come to their state. You know, the prime ones, of course, that have gotten the attention being Texas and New Mexico and Arizona and Oregon and Nevada. But states are coming, trying to recruit, because they know our taxes are high and our land prices are high and our educational system has not measured up to what it needs to be. And so we're vulnerable, I think very vulnerable. And Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network and I, as its leader, are determined to turn that around.
My guest today is Rebecca Morgan, a former California state senator and currently a leader in Silicon Valley. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. There are a number of initiatives that Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network has begun. Tell us about those initiatives.
It's a little hard to know which of our 13 initiatives your listeners might be most interested in. But we range from everything, helping people with startups, as I've mentioned, to an education initiative and a healthy community, healthy economy initiative focused on preventive health care. Those, we feel, the education initiative and the health care initiative are aimed at preparing the workforce to be better citizens and more productive and ready for the workforce. We have Smart Valley, which is is set up as a nonprofit to work on the applications of most of modern technology in our schools, in our healthcare arena, in our helping our nonprofits become fully linked. We have a software coalition that is looking to change how computer software engineers are trained in our higher education institutes, working with Santa Clara and the University of California at Santa Cruz and at Berkeley and with Stanford professors, realizing that today's software engineers aren't necessarily getting the education that they need for a 21st century multimedia development and those kinds of things. So we have a strong economic development piece that is just evolving. So much of what has happened in Austin, Texas, or in the state of Florida, as two examples, is just the economic development piece. How do you retain the jobs that we have, and how do you bring more jobs to the location for us, Silicon Valley? That is one very important piece of what we're doing. But it's just one of 13 that we're starting with. What I see happening over time is that Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network will be the launch pad, that not all of these 13 initiatives will remain within our network, that the Global Trading Center, for instance, has the goal of becoming self-supporting within 2 years. And I think that's a success for the network if we can help launch these initiatives. And then, you know, in 2 to 5 years, we determine whether or not there are some of our initiatives that need an ongoing parent, if you will, whether we can continue to be value-added, because that is important to me as the president and CEO of Joint Venture, is that what we do be value-added. And if we can help with regulatory streamlining by bringing process engineers and total quality management people together with city administrators to improve the processes, we will continue to do that. If we find that they have been self-taught or taken it on their own, then that initiative, in my view, should disappear. I would guess that tax and fiscal policy will always be an issue, and that is primarily aimed at lobbying those pieces of legislation that are most helpful to business and stability of local funding, as well as perhaps creating some ideas of what ought to happen in that area.
Do you see the skills of the people in Silicon Valley having to change necessarily?
I see our skills needing to change as far as being competent in technology. But I also hear over and over that it's just not the technical skills that are missing in today's high school graduates, that it is the communication skill, whether it's writing or speaking, or knowing how to interact and deal and negotiate with people, that there are many of the communication skills that aren't being taught, for instance, that is not just technical. There's certainly some of the basics of computation and comprehension of what you're reading continue to be a worry. And our hope would be that we could focus within our educational initiative, which has a board made up of CEOs of companies, K-12 superintendents, and four-year university presidents, to take a look at what would Silicon Valley look like if it were a world-class educational system. Not just piecemealing it, but what's our dream of become, if we were to be world-class, what would it look like? And what are the outcomes that we expect from our young people, both as far as academic and workforce preparation, but as citizens and contributing members of the community? Remember, our report was 21st Century Community. That's not just employees. That's how we as individuals function in our communities and become contributing members of the community.
During boom periods, a economies which are heavily based in technology often attract engineers or technical people with very unique skills. And quite often those skills aren't widened while the boom is on. Are we losing those people, and can retraining help?
I think both the retraining that's available in our community colleges and our adult education programs now are essential and must be protected. And that's my real worry with funding for education is K-12, yes, but also our community colleges, who are really educating the bulk of our young people that go beyond high school. So it's crucial that we continue our community college system as well as our higher education. But what I'm hoping for is to be recipients of some of that defense conversion money that President Clinton then is talking about, that maybe there will be a peace dividend, and we have certainly applied both for economic development money and for defense conversion funds from the federal government, and feel that with the defense conversion funds, the majority of it would go to retraining people from the defense and the space industries into the technologies that are evolving.
How are you going to measure success here? You've got so many activities going on.
Well, one of the charges that I see is coming in as President CEO is to build a structure and a sense of organization into this, what was many called a movement, an exciting creative movement over the last 18 months. Each of the initiatives are required to develop what's called a memorandum of understanding with the network board. That memorandum of understanding includes a mission, the structure of the initiative, whether it's going to be a nonprofit or whether it will continue just to be staffed by my staff. The memorandum requires measurable objectives. Now, that will vary from one initiative to the other. It may be that the Tax and Fiscal Council will successfully lobby two pieces of legislation that they think crucial to the Valley. We'll make two trips a year to Sacramento for that purpose. Or it may be that the Global Trading Center will have two trade shows outside of the United States that they take small companies to that couldn't afford to go there otherwise, and that they make 500 linkages around the world because they're setting up an electronic network. So each of these initiatives will have those measurable objectives, and we are putting in place in the next few months a benchmarking system, so that we can say to the public, this is what we set out to do, and we accomplished it or we didn't.
Now let me understand the structure, because I think it's fairly innovative, or perhaps it's innovative in the use of this organization.
Well, actually, we don't know of another structure such as ours anywhere in the country, much less the world. As I say, the economic development piece has been initiated in other areas, but our structure seems to be unique, and this is from the people that we're working with and from the consultants, the economists that have worked in several other parts of the country and the world, know of no other structure quite like ours.
So that people can, communities can, assemble their business people, assemble their government people, assemble their education people, assemble any bureaucracy that is necessary for things to move forward or might stand in the way, and in a friendly manner, bring them together. The organization, I'm assuming, is a not-for-profit organization.
Yes, we are a business not-for-profit, 501c6.
And so this is not a pseudo-government agency. This is truly a not-for-profit run by its volunteer board. And in this sense, they can go forward and say, who has what problems? Where are we going together? And then for small companies and little people, we can give them the access internationally or on a higher level that they wouldn't otherwise have, that there is a nice place here, if you will, for people to communicate from all of those positions so that they can reach a compromise for the public good.
A real challenge that we have is to act on our title, which is networking, to help people make connections. But what is important, in my view, is that we not lose our focus either, that we are focused on jobs. And we believe that's what it's going to take to rejuvenate Silicon Valley, so that we aren't working on transportation per se, mm-hmm. other than using our electronic networking and telecommuting, but we're not getting involved in social programs and transportation programs. We're trying to focus it on Silicon Valley, so that, and we've had calls from Africa and from Alabama and from Norway. The word is beginning to spread. But in this startup year, I feel very strongly that we must stay focused. We must not be redundant with what other associations and organizations are doing, that we must develop an organization in which we can measure what we're doing.
What's been the hardest thing in getting this off the ground?
Probably the hardest thing for joint venture will be to measure how many jobs we create, what can we legitimately take credit for, and to also know that it's probably not going to be a net gain, because we have lost so many jobs, and almost every week you pick up the paper and find another company that has laid off some workers. So you get a company that lays off 1,800 workers, and joint venture comes in and helps 10 new companies start companies that may provide 15 employees each. We are always running behind in a net number of jobs created. On the other hand, without us there, it would be worse.
Even though Silicon Valley is the technical capital of the world, you know, Many people I run into really aren't very technically oriented at all. Is that a problem?
Oh, I think that's one of the big challenges to Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network, is how do we help citizens become comfortable with technology? We start by trying to model it ourselves within our own office, and my young people start with me as an older citizen that didn't grow up in the computer age. And I think one of our real challenges is the electronic networking that we want to model, that access to internet, for instance, one of the biggest electronic networking systems in the country now, have it possible for our board members and the champions, the leaders of our initiatives, to be able to get real-time information on what's happening, to connect with each other by email or by internet, hooking in with the Mercury News, Mercury Center in San Jose. That is a real challenge, not only to help citizens become comfortable, but to use these tools to collaborate. I guess, Maura, one of the things that I think as a society we need to think about is how we avoid becoming a two-tier society, a one tier that has access to technology and learns to network and to communicate electronically, and a tier of our society that doesn't have access to computers, to telecommunications equipment, and gets left behind. And I think that's a real issue for our schools. Our libraries, for instance, could now be totally on a computerized system through internet, and yet you're going to have communities in which children and adults don't have access to that equipment, can't afford the membership charge, if you will, to hook up to an electronic network. And I think it's very important that we as a society look at how we stay as a community and don't establish a two-tier system.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Nice to be with you.
My guest today has been Rebecca Borgen. She is president and CEO of Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog,
call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.